Greetings and welcome on board WDKOK Sunrise. I'm Mark Lawrence. We're pre-recording this interview today so we can take advantage of the opportunity to meet and talk to two of the men in our area who are both very busy, and one of whom is co-author of a new book that is out. So we'll introduce him first. Jim Campbell is here. A lot of folks know him in Sealand's Grove. He's written a half a dozen books and a prolific author, to be sure, and is a person highly informed on the details and the nuances of sports and what has to be keen observations of that which is superlative in sports. And we're lucky to have him in our valley in the first place, but lucky to have him in our studio this morning. So good morning, Jim. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning, Mark. Good to be here.
I really appreciate it. Also, Fritz Heinemann is here. Of course, we know him as president of the Andy Russell Charitable Foundation Central Pennsylvania region. And we talked to him a lot lately about the all-inclusive playground. And believe it or don't, there is a Fritz and playground connection to this new book that is out. So we'll be talking to Fritz about that in a moment. Welcome aboard, sir.
Thank you. Good to be here with you, too, Mark.
Surround yourself with people that know what they're talking about is why Matt Cotrillo, a series of real sports fan. He's a broadcaster, does play-by-play on SCTV, and he stands to help us with some of our play-by-play from time to time. Steve Jones, show producer, is another title that he carries, and Real Sports Net, of course, he is news director here the rest of the day. Thanks for coming in, Matt.
Absolutely, Mark. Always a pleasure.
Appreciate that. Hell with the lid off, inside the fierce rivalry between the 1970s Oakland Raiders and Pittsburgh Steelers. Ed Groover, folks familiar with sports books out of Lancaster, we'll be familiar with him, and young Jim Campbell wrote this book. What's in Hell with the Lid Off?
Well, there's a lot of things in Hell with the Lid Off. Probably the first thing I should do is explain the title. In 1863, a writer from the Atlantic Monthly magazine described Pittsburgh as being hell with the lid off. And that was at the time where the steel mills were booming, the coke ovens, the soft coal was being burned, and it probably was hell with the lid off. But the rivalry between the Raiders and the Steelers was also a bit of hell with the lid off. And maybe the lid wasn't even off. I mean, those games were just unbelievable. And the way they were hitting, the way they were playing, the animosity between the players, and just the overall overview of that rivalry. It was a blood rivalry. It was a blood sport.
Now, you went to Pittsburgh to be a law student and wanted to be part of the Steelers organization, did research on elements, including the draft as it relates to the NFL, and the Steelers said in 1970, you can help us on the sidelines, and you started doing that.
That's right.
So you're working for the Steelers, watching from the sidelines. A couple of years passed, 1972. A couple of things happened in 72. Describe that year, because that's the start of this.
Well, the Steelers drafted very well ever since Chuck Noll got there. So you had the 69 draft, actually, which was Joe Green. You had 70, which was Bradshaw. Then you had Jack Ham come along and all the others. And it was really just a culmination of the team through the draft getting better. And the season was very successful. And the Steelers got to the playoffs. And the playoff game against the Raiders was played at Three Rivers Stadium. And that was a game that became known as the Immaculate Reception. It was a game that was, like all Steelers-Raiders games, hard-hitting, low-scoring, defensively oriented. And the Steelers were ahead on two Roy Girella field goals, 6-0, with about 2 minutes to play. Dwight White, a defensive end, got dinged, had to come out. A rookie went in at defensive end. He got hooked in on a play, and Kenny Stabler went 31 yards for what tying touchdown. Extra point put the Raiders ahead with less than 2 minutes to go. And I can remember thinking, well, maybe Preston Pearson, who is a kick returner, can bring one back and get Jarrell in field goal range. Well, they got a pretty good return, but not that good. And the Steelers were right around their 35-40-yard line. And Bradshaw threw three incompletions, and I'm thinking, boy, this doesn't look good. And then the Immaculate Reception occurred. I like to say that the football Frenchie Fuqua, Jack Tatum, all arrived at the same point in history at the same time. The ball ricocheted. Franco picked it out of the air off his shoe tops and proceeded to go into the touchdown.
Did he really catch it?
Yes, he did.
Didn't touch the ground?
The play that they show most frequently doesn't show him actually picking the ball off his shoe tops. But there is footage that gets shown every once in a while that shows it as a legitimate catch.
And you say in the book Chuck Noll didn't see this.
No, Chuck Noll saw it. Art Rooney didn't.
Oh, okay.
Art Rooney, the owner, as close to a saint as anyone I've ever met, was in the press box, thought like a lot of people that the game was over, wanted to be down in the locker room to congratulate the players on a great season, and he was in the elevator, and he hears a crowd, and he doesn't know why, and then he comes out of the elevator and finds out what happened. That Franco scored a touchdown, and the Steelers were going into the AFC Championship game the next week against the Dolphins.
And you saw this?
I saw this.
You didn't miss it.
I was standing there with Ray Mansfield, who was he alternated at center with Jim Clack, and we both looked at each other at the same time, said, "Man, I saw it, but I don't believe it." And then Mansfield, who was a real character and one of Andy Russell's best buddies, said, "Hey, we better get down to the end zone and get in the pictures." And every once in a while, NFL Films will show the footage of Mansfield trundling down the sideline, looking back to see where the cameras are, taking a few more steps, looking back. But he got down to the end zone, and along with thousands of others, by that time the people were coming out of the stands, and it was really bedlam.
And that play and that win starts the beginning of the end of meetings between the Oakland Raiders and Pittsburgh Steelers, where no holds barred, bloody, fierce, violent collisions. That's the next decade for Oakland and Pittsburgh.
That's true. If you're a Raiders fan, the Raiders were just aggressive. If you're a Steelers fan, they were dirty. The other side of the coin, if you were a Steelers fan, Dwight White was just aggressive. If you weren't a Steelers fan, he was a dirty player. So somewhere in the middle lies the truth. But those games were awful. I mean, George Atkinson gives a forearm to the back of Lynn Swann's head and knocks him out. And the play is over. Swann is nowhere near the play. And it was just a blatant, dirty, cheap shot. And that was just typical of the whole series. The Steelers probably weren't choir boys either, but it was football like you don't see played today.
Well, and you had Steelers who would all go on to be Hall of Famers staring down Jack Tatum and Ken Stabler. So, I mean, they're not slouches on the other side of that line either. There are rule changes that emerge from this rivalry and the tough play of some of these guys. Tell us about that.
Well, Mel Blount was, in fact, he's being named as one of the great cornerbacks of all time, a Hall of Famer. He was pretty handy with his forearms. I think he thought the best way to break up a pass was to come across the receiver's face mask with both forearms. And there was actually a lawsuit because Chuck Noll referred to the Raiders as a criminal element. And the Raiders brought a lawsuit. And in the testimony, Noll alluded to the fact that Mel Blount wasn't a choir boy either. And that caused a little consternation in Pittsburgh. Actually, Mel Blount sued Chuck Noll. But that lawsuit was dropped, and Blount went on to play at least 10 more years of really top quality defensive cornerback. There was a saying that two-thirds of the earth is covered by water, the other third by Mel Blount. He was that good.
Well, you're certainly right about that, Jim. So, I just this is the sports fan coming out of me a little bit here, because every time I've gone to the Heinz Museum in Pittsburgh, or even the Pro Football Hall of Fame in Canton, for that reason, I get goosebumps looking at the exact turf in which the Franco Harris made the immaculate reception. You know, his shoes, all the relics from that play, that game. Do you still pinch yourself that, man, I saw one of the greatest plays in NFL history?
I remind myself about it. I also have made a little bit of a living off of it. I've done several magazine articles, several newspaper articles. I've been interviewed about it. And about every year around this time, somebody will bring it up. So it's something that has lived on. And truly, I think it was NFL. Well, I know it was NFL Films. But I think what they did is they determined by a poll of so many experts that it was the one greatest play in NFL history. And I'd have to agree.
I definitely would agree myself. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, so much going on. You have Terry Bradshaw just miraculously escaping near tackles.
Exactly.
Of course, and he's at the end of his line in the pocket by the time, you know, the pocket collapses on him, gets the ball off, bounces off the helmet of, who does it bounce off of?
Well, it was Frenchie Fuqua and Tatum collided. And the rule at that time was, two offensive players couldn't touch the ball. So if Fuqua was the first, then Franco could not be the second. The Raiders contended that it was Fuqua that gave impetus to the ball. But it had to be Tatum, because the ball ricocheted right back. And if it would have been off of Fuqua's hands, it would have continued downfield. But it came back to where Franco was. It was a line drive. It wasn't a Texas Ligger bloop or whatever. There was a retired professor from Carnegie Mellon that went frame by frame and concluded positively that's exactly what happened.
Well, yeah, but where's Carnegie Mellon? I mean,
yeah, right.
Yeah, I hope he brings a Steeler bias to this. How tough was the NFL becoming at that time? We're talking about, you know, folks like Rocky Blyer and some of the toughest players that are out there.
Well, you had Joe Green. You had Jack Lambert, who someone says probably hates his mother. I mean, he just was. Jack was a bit of a loner. He, on the sidelines, he stayed off by himself, and nobody went up to him to talk to him, least of all me. And Franco was like that, too. Franco stayed away from his teammates. He just paced up and down, you know, have the cape around him, and he just looked like a Roman gladiator. He could have played Spartacus or Russell Crowe or any of those people. I mean, it was just really something. But the thing about the Steelers, their defense at that time, everybody hit like a linebacker. I mean, the safeties and the cornerbacks, Blunt, Glenn Edwards. Glenn Edwards, before the first Super Bowl against the Vikings, the teams are in the waiting to get out on the field, but they're together. And Glenn Edwards is about 185 pounds, maybe 5'11". And he goes up to I think it was Alan Page. And he says, "You better buckle up your helmet today, boy, because you're going to get your ass kicked," if I can say that.
Well, and so, who else is on these teams? Name the rest of the players. And who's on Oakland? I don't know too much about football, but I know these guys, too.
Well, the Steelers' front line was L.C. Greenwood, Ernie Holmes, Joe Green, and Dwight White. The linebackers were Andy Russell, Jack Lambert in the middle, and Jack Hamm on the cornerbacks. The safeties were every one of those Steelers, with the exception of Ernie Holmes. And Holmes certainly was worthy. The Raiders had, Klein was a good defensive lineman. Monty Johnson was a linebacker. Phil Villapiano, a very vocal linebacker. Their defensive backfield was Tatum, Skip Thomas, a.k.a. Dr. Death, George Atkinson of the famed forearm to the back of the head. Just a lot of great players. You had the owner, Hal Davis, Hall of Famer. Coach John Madden, Hall of Famer. Had Chuck Knoll, Hall of Famer. And, of course, Bradshaw was the quarterback. And it was just intense, intense football.
And Andy Russell, not a Hall of Famer yet.
That's true. And Andy played as a rookie in 63. So he was on the downside of his career when the Steelers were getting good. But he was a real contributor. He was very intelligent, very intense, studied the game, knew what was going on, was hardly ever out of position, if ever. And he was a vital part of the Steelers, although he was only there for the first two of the four Super Bowls.
When you look back at those teams, Jim, especially the 72 team, what stands out to you the most about that group? You have 26 Hall of Famers combined with both teams, but these guys really just brought it every single game that they played each other.
They did, and I think that was all Chuck Knoll's approach. Chuck, more than anything, was a teacher. He would tell the scouting department, he said, you find us the athletes, we'll make them into NFL players. And he did that. There was an unsung hero of that team, or that organization at the time, was Bill Nunn. He was a writer for the Pittsburgh Courier, which is a black newspaper, and he scouted the historically black colleges, which hardly anybody else was doing. He discovered Ernie Holmes, Dwight White, L.C. Greenwood, Glenn Edwards, J.T. Thomas, and just so many of them. And what he was doing, he was so thorough that he would go to the dances the night after a black college football game to see how nimble and look at the footwork of the big offensive and defensive linemen.
So anybody could be big on the line, but you got to be nimble, too.
You got to bend at the waist.
Quick off the line. Well, we are talking to Jim Campbell, lives in Sealands Grove. He has co-written a book with Ed Groover of Lancaster, Hell with the Lid Off, Inside the Fierce Rivalry Between the 1970s Oakland Raiders and Pittsburgh Steelers. Fritz Heinemann is with us. This is an appropriate share for Fritz now, too, because you're going to donate proceeds of this.
That's right.
Tell me more about that. What's the Andy Russell-Fritz Heinemann connection?
Well, Fritz has made Andy what he is today. I refer to him as Fritz the Facilitator. Seriously, he's just an outstanding individual, doing what he can, helping where he can, and accomplishing an awful lot of good. I'm just so pleased to be a minuscule part of the all-inclusive playground. I see what it does, I see what it provides, and I can't help but mention a youngster who's no longer with us, Josiah Vieira, suffered from a very, very tragic disease. But to me, he typifies the help that the all-inclusive playground provides. And because of Andy Russell and because of Fritz, that's why the all-inclusive playground is in Sealands Grove.
And Andy Russell, of course, contributed a lot of the funding that went into this, has the foundation going. He's been to these studios, he and Cindy, participating in interviews, making sure that this is brought up and talked about and is top of the mind of people around here. Some of the proceeds of this book, Hell with the Lid Off, go to the playground.
Jim has been very generous in supporting the playground in a number of ways. And of course, it's always interesting to me about the little, what I call the spider web of life, how you become involved with people and then find out that they know somebody that you know, and all of a sudden you have this network relationship going. So not to belabor the point, because the playground is 98% complete. We're just wrapping up last-minute details. But as Jim mentioned, he and I became friends largely through Andy. And so when he co-authored this book and asked if Andy would do the foreword, Andy, of course, was thrilled and did it. And Jim just said, well, we're going to give part of the proceeds from the sale of the book to the playground. And so that's our tie-in, and he's part of the concluding act, the successful concluding act of the Everyone's Playground, the all-inclusive playground.
Folks want to contribute. How do we do so? Remind them.
It's very easy. GoFundMe all-inclusive playground. That's the easiest way. And the other, of course, is to track me down wherever you can find me. And we'll be happy to take cash, checks, anything that we can turn into revenue. We'll accept.
And every 2 months, I eat lunch with you at the Dairy Queen. So
we have that
please.
Coming up, what, next week,
yep,
I think?
Yep, Simona yep. Lovac takes good care of us down there, so we appreciate that. What else should we ask, Jim, if we're going to talk about this book in this era, Hell with the Lid Off? What else should we know about before we move on here?
Well, you ought to realize after watching this weekend's games that this was really the start of the NFL as the most dominant sport. Somewhere in the 60s, NFL football replaced baseball. But when you look at that game from the 60s and you look at today's game, or you look at the game from the 70s and 80s on, it wasn't quite what the game is today. It's a national obsession. I mean, how many people are not in fantasy football leagues? How many people don't bet legally or illegally on the game?
At this table, but anyway, go ahead.
I do the fantasy football. I have two teams, so yeah, we got that going.
Yeah. And being somewhat of a cynic and being a little disillusioned with the way the NFL is run now, I say there are two things that keep the NFL alive: fantasy football and gambling. And I mean, there are people that they probably wouldn't walk across the street to look at a game, go to a game, if it wasn't they had a few bucks on it or they're in a fantasy league. So.
One more question, please.
Yes, and actually, I read the foreword that Andy wrote, and what struck me was he said when he saw the Immaculate Reception, "I just don't believe it." I think that was pretty much the most common phrase that everybody saw from that. How would you describe the sideline of the Steelers? Was it mostly shock? Was it insane celebration? Was a little bit of both? How would you, when you think back on that, what do you remember about the sideline when Franco Harris makes the Immaculate Reception?
Well, it was disbelief at first, but then it was quickly replaced by elation. And as with, you know, Mansfield running down to get in the pictures, Jack Ham contends that he was sitting with his back to the play, but there's pictures of the sideline that shows Jack Ham most interested in the play.
Well, yeah, it was the last play of that particular playoff game, and their only hope at that point, waning.
I think they had to kick off to the Raiders. There were a few seconds left. So,
thank you so much, Jim.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Come back and talk to us again. Jim Campbell, Sealands Grove, prolific author, half a dozen books and dozens of articles and lots of words and information and trivia and information about sports, Cal Ripken Jr., and a wide range of other superlative topics within sports. Fritz Heinemann came along from Sealands Grove of the Andy Russell Charitable Foundation. Matt Cotrillo is our news director, Steve Jones Show producer, broadcaster, and he's here today to make sure that I didn't miss the obvious questions here or
you did a very good job. Yeah,
explain more about what fantasy football is when we're off mic here. Thank you all so much, men. Thanks for coming in.
You're welcome.
Thank you.